Welcome to the Misgav Institute for National Security's Mideast Horizons podcast. This is a podcast for anyone who wants to understand what's happening in the Middle East, from Israel to Iran, from the Abraham Accords to the Axis of Terror, from great power to people on the street. It's for anyone who really wants to understand what's happening and how it's going to impact you, whether you're sitting in the US, Europe, India, the Middle East, or anywhere else.
The Misgav Institute for National Security is Israel's leading national security policy center dedicated to strengthening Israel's national security, regional cooperation and integration, and international alliances and partnerships. We work with decision makers and policy shapers around the world in order to shape a future for the Middle East based on security, stability, peace, and prosperity for all.
We're really excited to have you on our new podcast. We welcome all our new listeners, and we want to tell you a little bit about ourselves and what we're going to do here every week. I'm your co-host, Lahav Harkov, the Misgav Institute's senior fellow and senior political correspondent for Jewish Insider.
And I'm Asher Fredman, executive director of the Misgav Institute. Every week, we are going to bring you fresh insights and clear, concise, deep analysis of what's really going on in the Middle East, beyond the headlines, beyond the slogans, cutting through the noise, helping you understand what you need to know about this incredible region. And we're going to discuss not only the critical developments on the national security agenda, but also the exciting trends and opportunities in this rapidly evolving region, which can impact your lives and which you can take advantage of as well. We're going to tell you what you need to know about the Middle East today, tomorrow, and into the future.
Every week, we're going to have an exciting guest with a unique perspective on current events, on the Middle East, and hopefully on what we might see next in the region. You'll have a chance to hear from newsmakers, agenda setters, and people who were and still are in the room where it happens.
This week, we have a very special guest. We'll be joined by Ambassador Robert O'Brien, who served as United States National Security Advisor under President Trump during his first term from 2019 to 2021. He today serves, he continues to serve on President Trump's Intelligence Advisory Board and as an informal advisor, as well as chairman of American Global Strategies. Ambassador O'Brien orchestrated the historic Abraham Accords. He oversaw the maximum pressure campaign on Iran during President Trump's first term. He increased America's cooperation with its allies in the Indo-Pacific, and he played a key role in helping to build America's military and defense strength. There's no better time than now for a conversation with Ambassador O'Brien. We'd like to thank our sponsors of this podcast, Amy and Jonathan Ayers. For future sponsorship opportunities and any comments and suggestions you might have about the podcast guest formats, please reach out to us at MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. That's MideastHorizonsPodcast@gmail.com. You can follow the Misgav Institute on social media at our website.
We want to ask all of our listeners to please subscribe and follow wherever you're listening to us. Forward this to your friends so that all of you can keep up on everything happening in the Middle East. This is going to be our regular rundown segment of all the things you need to know in the Middle East. So we are going to start with what you need to know about what's happening in Israel and the region. We are recording this the day after President Trump announced a ceasefire between Israel and Iran. Shortly before that ceasefire was meant to come into effect, Iran shot missiles into Israel that killed 4 Israelis, and then they shot 3 more missiles in the hours after the ceasefire took effect. Those did not cause any loss of life. Israel was gearing up for a serious response, as the prime minister, chief of staff, and others said. But then President Trump wrote on Truth Social to turn the planes around. He dropped an F-bomb on the way onto Air Force One to express his frustration with both Israel and Iran. This caused a lot of confusion in Jerusalem, where officials said they had been reassured by President Trump that Israel would be able to respond to any violations by Iran. Ultimately, after a conversation between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump, Israel had a symbolic strike on a radar installation in Iran. And now we are left to see whether the ceasefire will continue to hold. But some of the other important things to know, before the ceasefire, the day before, Israel struck important Iranian regime sites around Tehran, including the notorious Evin prison, a symbol of the Islamic Republic's oppression of activists, journalists, and others, as well as the doomsday clock counting down to Israel's destruction. But maybe even more importantly than that, Israel killed hundreds of militants in the Basij, the regime's internal enforcement arm, instrumental in suppressing protests and enforcing Islamic law. The IDF has also said it's destroyed most of Iran's missile launchers, which is more important than even how many missiles it destroyed, because without launchers, you can't shoot the missiles. Now, questions still remain about the effectiveness of the American strike on the nuclear facilities in Fordo, Natanz, and Isfahan. Listeners may know that Fordo was the site that Israel really needed American help to bomb because Israel did not have the what's called massive ordnance penetrator, the bunker buster bombs to drop on Fordo, which is a nuclear facility buried under a mountain, nor did Israel have the aircraft, the B-2 bombers needed to carry those bombs. The U.S. dropped those bombs on the three nuclear facilities. There was some talk that perhaps Iran had moved some of its highly enriched uranium out of the facilities when Israel began the war. And the latest assessments, as we talk, are that, in fact, the vast majority of the uranium was in those facilities and that the bombing was effective. But still remains to be seen because, of course, there have not been any international Atomic Energy Agency inspectors on the ground. So we may continue to learn more. Iran, shortly before the ceasefire, sought to strike back at the U.S. and shot missiles at the Al Udeid Air Base in Qatar, just across the Gulf. However, news came out shortly after that the entire thing was sort of orchestrated and coordinated with the U.S. The U.S. cleared out staff and service members from the base. The Qataris were prepared in advance. It seemed that Iran just wanted to show that it was doing something in order to save face. We also have a civil war happening in MAGA, the Make America Great Again movement. You had prominent isolationists like Tucker Carlson who were disappointed that Trump did the strike in Iran. There were people like Turning Point's Charlie Kirk and One America News Network and former Congressman Matt Gaetz who were very skeptical about it, but then started to speak more positively after the strike actually happened. All are very happy about the ceasefire now. The question is Trump sort of reaching out to the restrainers once again? Will they start changing their tune now that they see that Trump hasn't done exactly what they thought American policy should look like? These are more questions that we'll be looking out for in the coming days. Now that I'm done with my monologue about the latest news from the Middle East, Asher, I want to pick your brain. What do you think is coming next? Is the ceasefire going to hold? What does this mean for Iran's nuclear program, its ballistic missile program? Tell us what's on your mind.
So the situation is very fragile and very complex. There's no doubt that Iran's nuclear and ballistic missile programs have been set back very extensively, but there are also important divisions or differences in the way that the different players are approaching this. So President Trump has spoken primarily about the nuclear program. Prime Minister Netanyahu has talked about two existential threats facing Israel, the nuclear program and the ballistic missile program. We saw what kind of damage one ballistic missile could do. And we can only imagine what would happen if Iran had 10,000 ballistic missiles and was capable of firing many of them simultaneously.
And we should note, right, that Israel has destroyed most of Iran's missile launchers, but, Iran still has many of them left. They're still capable of shooting a missile at Israel that could cause great destruction.
Exactly. And now, again, if you're sitting in UAE, in Saudi Arabia, or in India, you are probably relieved that the war is over without causing extensive economic disruption in the region. But the question is really, as you said, what comes next? And especially what comes next when Iran tries to rebuild potentially its nuclear program and almost certainly its ballistic missile program? And does Israel react? And how does the United States approach an Israeli attempt to enforce this dismantlement of the ballistic missile program?
And we saw today that, Trump is very much on Israel, has very much been on Israel's side and very supportive of Israel, but he's also not hesitant to call Israel out in public and even equate Israel and Iran in a way that was pretty surprising from Trump. I mean, you have to think that there has to be some sort of plan or ulterior motive here, not only because the U.S. and Israel have been so tricky in the last couple of weeks, but also just because it's just not sort of what his MO has been. So what do you think about that?
I agree with you that we have been repeatedly surprised by the successful coordination of sort of the storyline and the difference between that and what's really happening behind closed doors. I do think, though, that President Trump is very proud of the fact that he accomplished two main goals. One, preventing Iran from achieving a nuclear weapon. Obviously, Israel's strikes had a major impact, and then America's Operation Midnight Hammer was very consequential. And then also bringing about peace and keeping the United States out of an extended war. So he's able to go to essentially both sides of, you mentioned the MAGA movement, the America First movement, and say, look, I was able to do both. And I think he's very concerned that either side might disrupt one of those achievements, particularly the second one. But again, we've seen, for example, how Israel has repeatedly struck Lebanon in order to prevent Hezbollah from rebuilding. We know that Iran, the regime, it might have been weakened, but it's a wounded regime and it's looking to restore its pride, its dignity, to take revenge. And I assume that it will make every effort to get as many destructive weapons as quickly as it can, as many threatening capabilities as quickly as it can. And then Israel reacts, and this might indeed lead to a divergence of opinions and even a clash between Israel and the United States.
Yeah, I think that President Trump, he's very sort of enamored of the idea that he's going to be the peacemaker, but he doesn't have full control of the situation as much as he'd like to think he does. And the Iranians, you know, the Iranians fear America, right? They don't want a direct confrontation with America, but they don't see threatening Israel and continuing to use its proxies to attack Israel and even shooting missiles at Israel as a confrontation with America. And frankly, I'm not sure America sees it that way either. So it is a concern. This might be like going too far, but I think that there's a concern that it might even be what's called October 6th thinking, as people say in Israel, you know, that Israel was willing to enter sort of to finish rounds of fighting with Hamas in a very inconclusive way in order to just like not fight a war anymore, you know, and accept the status quo. And while we have had huge achievements in this 12-day war with Iran, the ending is a little bit bittersweet, in part because of the loss of life in the last 12 days, but also because, you know, I think there is a lot of uncertainty about whether Iran will once again be a threat to Israel.
And we should recall that Israel defines, officially, the cabinet defined the goals of this operation as degrading and dismantling the nuclear and ballistic program. But obviously, we heard a lot of talk over the last few days, including from the Israeli leadership, even from a post by President Trump himself, considering the possibility of regime change. We saw the Iranian crown prince come out in a very dramatic video calling on his countrymen and women to rise up and retake their country. Israel's messaging has consistently been that we're not at war with the Iranian people. We only want peace with the Iranian people. I was even joking that we might see normalization with Tehran before we see normalization with Riyadh, but that's probably unlikely. And there is a question of whether or not we've missed an opportunity to really change. Obviously, neither America nor Israel is going to put boots on the ground. Neither of them are going to engage in nation building. But did we miss an opportunity to empower the Iranian people to build a better future and build their nation, make Iran great again? And I think that's a question that we're going to have to face over the next months and years as we see the Ayatollah regime, which, first of all, go on a rampage of repression to reassert its authority and also to rebuild its military capabilities. But again, I don't think we should lose sight, though, of the tremendous accomplishments that Israel achieved over the last 12 days.
So like a few hours before we recorded this podcast, I interviewed Natan Sharansky about this very question. And he said that, you know, the conversation that people have been having about regime change doesn't really make sense. Like, regime change isn't like bombing Fordo, you know, do you have the right, you can't just cause regime change through airstrikes, right? It has to come from the people themselves. And he detects serious movement on the ground with different dissident movements, maybe starting to work together to try to do things. So I hope that there's some reason for optimism. But you might be right that the response will now be extremely repressive. I think like that there's a moral statement that has to be made, and that there are ways to influence the situation in Iran to move towards undermining the Ayatollah's regime rather than trying to force regime change through military means. I mean, and if you look at like how the Soviet Union collapsed, right? So it's a different situation. You're not going to get into like a spending war with Iran because they're not on the path, on the level of the US, but there was, you know, small steps towards openness so that people were less afraid. But also the world took a strong moral stance, especially the United States took a strong moral stance against the Soviet Union, which is why I found it very heartening when President Trump posted on Truth Social, it's not politically correct, but why not talk about regime change? Why not talk about make Iran great again? And Prime Minister Netanyahu said sort of he refused to rule it out. You know, I thought that that was heartening in the sense that it's an important moral stance that the free world needs to take. And then I found it disappointing after the ceasefire that President Trump walked it back and said, no, no, we prefer stability. I think that it would be, it is perhaps not, you know, the way President Trump operates, but I think it would be good for American leadership and leadership of the free world generally to say, no, actually, the repressive totalitarian dictatorship of the Ayatollah is a bad thing.
I think that's a really good point. And something else that I took note of from that ex post that you mentioned was President Trump's ability and willingness to say, why not change paradigms? Why not think differently? Why not reshape the situation? And I think that's a mindset that Israel has slowly been adopting since October 7th, since the shock and the tragedy and the breaking point of October 7th, forcing Israel to reconsider its paradigms, its conventions, its illusions, in a sense. And then that's going to come up in a lot of different arenas now that the operation in Iran is in a ceasefire, is perhaps in a pause. And the question is, what happens next in Gaza? Do we create new paradigms and new ways of thinking and really shape a new reality for the Gaza Strip? And that also might apply in Judea and Samaria, in the West Bank as well. At some point, President Abbas will no longer be the leader of the Palestinian Authority. I think he's in the 20th year of his four-year term. And again, do we want to continue more of the same paradigms, the same ways of thinking that have led us to where we are today for the last 30 years? Or do you want to adopt new paradigms? And I do think that Israel, post-October 7th, and President Trump, with his willingness to certainly think outside the box, that creates some very interesting possibilities that we hope we have a chance to explore on this in future episodes. Now, today we're joined by a very special guest, Ambassador Robert C. O'Brien. Ambassador O'Brien served as U.S. National Security Advisor from 2019 to 2021 during President Trump's first term. Before that, he served as the U.S. Special Envoy for Hostage Affairs and was directly involved in bringing home 25 American hostages and detainees back to the United States. As National Security Advisor, he oversaw the Abraham Accords, the maximum pressure campaign on Iran, the strengthening of the U.S. military, and many other critical national security issues. Today, he is a member of President Trump's Intelligence Advisory Board, as well as the co-founder and chairman of American Global Strategies. And it is a great pleasure. We are very much looking forward to this conversation with Ambassador O'Brien. Ambassador O'Brien, it's great to have you on the Miskav Institute Mideast Horizons podcast. It would be a pleasure and a privilege to speak to you on any day, but especially a day like today, a historic day, a historic period for Israel, for Iran, for the Middle East, for the United States. We're very, very excited for this conversation.
Well, thank you. It's great to be with you. And it's been really good news the past few days. And it looks like the national security of Israel and the United States has been improved dramatically with this these recent attacks on the Iranian nuclear program. And hopefully they're as effective as they appear to be, and the world will be a lot safer.
What do you think, you know, the ceasefire is very shaky right now. Immediately after it was supposed to go into effect, Iran violated it, and then Israel started striking back, and President Trump said, turn the planes around. So where do you think things are going to go with this ceasefire, with Iran in the Middle East and its nuclear program?
Well, listen, I think the Iranians are always in the axis of resistance, the Hamas, Hezbollah, the Khatib Hezbollah, they're always very reticent to live up to their word and to agree to a ceasefire, because they think they can get an advantage in pressing their violence against Israel and against the United States. So we'll have to see if they live up to it. But I think it was a strong response from Prime Minister Netanyahu to the breach of the ceasefire by the Iranians. Of course, President Trump is frustrated because he's a peacemaker. He wants to see peace. And so I think he's frustrated with both sides that this didn't wrap up this morning like he'd asked. But I do think there's a lot of pressure on both parties, Israel and Iran, to adhere to the ceasefire. And hopefully it'll stay in a lot of death and destruction that we've seen in Tel Aviv, but also in Tehran will end.
Do you think that we perhaps missed an opportunity to further weaken the Iranian Ayatollah regime and to empower the Iranian people to rise up and change their regime?
You know, I've been talking about this for some time, and you know, I thought this might be the opportunity that the Iranian people could finally get their freedom. But you know, it's very difficult to bring democracy and freedom at the point of the barrel of a gun to these countries. We tried it very, you know, we put a lot of effort into Afghanistan. I was on a rule of law program there for many years under both Republican and Democrat presidents. Iraq, we had a lot of boots on the ground for a long time. We put a lot of money into Iraq and didn't get to where, you know, really where we wanted to be. And so, you know, the Iranian people, ultimately, you know, we can influence regime change, but that's if the Iranian people. And it's tough for them because, look, the ayatollahs and mullahs and theocrats are so, you know, brutal and cruel that they'll, if the people go out to protest, whether it's women with hijabs or, you know, gays or lesbians or whatever the minority group is, Azeris, they'll just be shot down and mowed down and killed by the Bajis and the secret police in Iran. So it's a tough place to have a peaceful revolution or a peaceful protest because you'll be killed. So, you know, everything that we did to weaken the regime so far, and that Israel has done to weaken the regime so far, is to the benefit of the Iranian people. But at the end of the day, you know, we can't impose a democracy. We can't impose freedom on Iran. They're going to have to take it, and we'll see if the regime is weakened enough to be the catalyst for them to go back to the streets and then have the power to take back their country. But you know, I'm hoping for the best on that front, but you know, it's very difficult to dislodge these tyrannical regimes.
You know, regime change has become this sort of dirty word in Washington. It's sort of been at the center of this internal fight within the sort of Trump supporter coalition, where a lot of them really were opposed to any American strike on Iran. How much influence do you think the sort of more quote unquote restrainers are having on President Trump, especially now after the ceasefire where he, you know, Trump previously said, make Iran great again, sort of down with the Ayatollah. And now he's saying he wants stability. And maybe the fact that he didn't want Israel to respond to Iran's violations of the ceasefire, you know, could that be influence of the restrainers? What do you think their role is here?
You know, I think the split between the, you know, purported split between the restrainers and the interventionists is a little bit overblown. I think most people did not want Iran to have a bomb. At the same time, most people did not want to have American boots on the ground in Tehran. I mean, we don't want to have patrols of American young men and women, you know, in Iran. And so, but both things can be true at the same time. Iran, you know, keeping Iran from getting a bomb is critical to American interests. And I posit that it's the most America first foreign policy you can have is keeping them from getting the bomb. You know, these are people that from the start of the revolution, they took American diplomats hostage for 444 days. They killed them through their newly formed party in Lebanon, the Party of God, Hezbollah. They blew up the U.S. Embassy and the Marine barracks and killed more Americans. They killed Americans in Khobar Towers in Saudi Arabia. They killed Americans in Afghanistan and in Iraq with roadside bombs and IEDs. October 7 was obviously an attack against Israel by Hamas, that Iran's proxy, but that would not have happened without Iranian approval. And over 30 Americans were killed in that attack, in addition to Israel, 1,200 Israelis being killed. So this is a regime that's had their followers go to the mosques on Friday and chant "Death to America" every Friday for 40 years, and they've killed the hundreds, if not thousands, of American civilians and military servicemen and women. So the idea of them getting a nuclear weapon and a ballistic missile capability so that they could deliver it is just absurd. It's ridiculous. It can't happen. President Trump understood that, and so to protect America, much less Israel, but protect ourselves, we had to take this action that we took. But at the same time, President Trump's not interested in going out, and trying to change the facts on the ground of the regime and put we don't need another Fallujah or that sort of situation with Americans in combat in Iran, which is probably what it would take to change the regime. So I think that President Trump has threaded the needle between those who are interventionists and wanted to eliminate the nuclear capacity of Iran, and at the same time, those who don't want to see us involved in the long-term Middle Eastern war with American boots on the ground in a Middle Eastern country.
All around the world, there are now media commentators, intelligence analysts, people trying to understand what are the guiding principles of President Trump. Now, you were not only his national security advisor for 2019 to 2020. You continue to sit on the president's intelligence advisory board. You continue to be an advisor to the president. How would you, if you had to break down President Trump's approach to national security or foreign policy in two or three principles, and maybe that's being a bit unfair, but could you sort of extract the essence of what you think President Trump's approach to the international arena and to national security might be?
So that's a great question, Asher. And I think it comes down to, he talks about putting America first. What does that mean? And the first thing it means is for our foreign allies and partners, America first does not mean America alone. And we throughout the first Trump term and throughout this term, President Trump has worked closely with allies. In this case, Israel, he and Bibi Netanyahu. Yeah, they had a little spat this morning, I guess, over the ceasefire, but they've worked hand in glove, and both Bibi has said that, and President Trump has said that, and so you've seen the results of Israel taking out all the air defense systems and clearing the way for American bombers to come in and take out Fordo and some of the Natanz and Esfahan. So you can see America first doesn't mean America alone, but it means that we're gonna put our interests, are paramount, but we can work with our friends and allies and benefit from that cooperation. We're certainly going to do it. But the next principle, and President Trump said this at the UN in 2019, when he defined what America first means, he said it means peace through strength. I mean, it's classic Ronald Reagan, and he cites Ronald Reagan all the time. And if you're strong, both militarily but economically, and if you're willing to demonstrate that strength, you achieve the goal of peace with strength isn't to say, hey, we've got so many aircraft carriers or so many howitzers or so many tanks or so many ships, and it's not a bragging rights match. It's to be stronger so that our adversaries don't press our partners and allies and don't press America with their malign activities. And if we can demonstrate that strength, then we can get to the end goal of peace, because the peace through strength, the idea is to get to peace, a state of peace. It's not to have war and dominate. It's to get to a state of peace. And so, I look at the classic example, and it's a long answer to your question, so I'm sorry, but I look at the classic example of the Abraham Accords. What do we do? The U.S. took out Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and eliminated the ISIS caliphate. That was very important to our Arab allies, so they could see that we were going to stand with them against some other Muslim Brotherhood ideology and the radicals. We took out Qasem Soleimani, who was menacing us in Iraq and Lebanon and Syria, and was a threat to both Israel and the United States. So President Trump demonstrated significant strength. He moved the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem, which everyone said, don't do it, it'll cause trouble in the Arab street and it'll cause another intifada. He recognized Israeli sovereignty over Golan. He gave the UAE the weapons they needed to defend themselves against Iran, the high-tech weapons. So all those things laid the groundwork. All those demonstrations of strength laid the groundwork for the Abraham Accords. That's how we got to the end state of peace between the UAE and Israel and Bahrain and ultimately Morocco and Kosovo and Sudan. But I think President Trump wants to be a peacemaker. He's a tough guy. It may be counterintuitive, but he really doesn't like war. He doesn't like, as he calls it, death and destruction. He wants peace, and through strength, it's strength of his will and character, through strength of American diplomacy, and through demonstrations of strength to our adversaries, as we saw with the attack, the air raid on Iran's nuclear facilities recently. Yeah, we can then hopefully get to the end state of peace, which is what we all want. You know, men and women around the world, we want, you know, peace and freedom, and American strength will help get us there.
So I want to pick up on something you said, because you talked about America killing Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi and Qasem Soleimani as sort of steps that made the Abraham Accords countries trust the U.S. more, want to partner with the U.S. more. What impact do you think that this, the 12-day war, as Trump is calling it, between Israel and Iran and the U.S. participation in it, what impact do you think that'll have on the Abraham Accords and the prospects for expanding it? Because their public statements are that they condemned certainly the Israeli attacks. But what do you think is going on behind this?
Look, again, I haven't been in the region recently since the war started, but I think the reaction from the, especially from the Gulf Arabs, has been very mild. And I think behind the scenes, what I'm hearing from diplomats here and friends and over the phone and over text messages is that the Gulf Arabs are very happy with the cutting down of this Shia, radical Shia regime in Iran that's been a cloud and a pall over the region for 40 years, really. And the nuclear issue was very dangerous, because if Iran had developed a nuclear weapon, number one, they've said that Israel is a one bomb state. In other words, if they could get just one bomb through, they could eliminate the people, the Jewish people, and have a second genocide and eliminate Israel. But it was also a threat to the Gulf monarchies and their friends and neighbors, across the Strait of Hormuz. So if Iran had gotten a weapon, there's no doubt in my mind that Saudi Arabia would have immediately gotten nuclear, probably by buying weapons from Pakistan. But the UAE would have probably developed nuclear weapons very, very quickly. There's no way the Turks, who are the historic adversary of Iran, would have gone, stayed conventional with Iran nuclear armed. And then you got Egypt, the leader of the, which still views itself as the leader of the Arab world. They would have had gone nuclear. So we would have had a nuclear arms race in the most dangerous part of the world, and a pretty tough neighborhood. That would not have been good for the region or for the world. So I think that there's a lot of support for eliminating the Iranian nuclear capacity. President Trump gave them the chance to do it peacefully. They didn't, and so they had to take military action.
Mr. O'Brien, if I can take you to what I think might become a sensitive situation, potentially even in the near future. President Trump is very much focused on the nuclear threat, whereas Prime Minister Netanyahu has spoken about two existential threats that Iran poses, the nuclear threat and the ballistic missile threat, because 10,000 ballistic missiles, we saw what damage one or two can do. 10,000 would be an existential threat. Now, it seems likely that in the near future, Iran may try to, even if it pauses its nuclear program, to rebuild its ballistic missile program, in which case Israel might want to, like it does in Lebanon, where it's repeatedly striking Hezbollah in order to prevent it from rebuilding its military capacities. It might want to strike Iran to prevent it from rebuilding its ballistic missile capabilities. And on the other hand, that's not the heart of negotiations, at least sort of very much on the table in the discourse to date between the United States and Iran. So what happens, what would you counsel President Trump and also Prime Minister Netanyahu or American and Israeli decision makers if and when we see Iran trying to rebuild its ballistic missile program?
Yeah, look, we can't let that happen. We saw what they've done with the ballistic missile program over the past year since October 7th. They've struck Israel. They've basically three barrages, right? The ongoing barrages that have been taking place the past couple of days, but two previous occasions, they've used ballistic missiles to attack Israel. And look, if they get further along with their ballistic missile program, that they could attack Europe or the United States. So, yeah, well, one of the problems with the JCPOA, the Obama nuclear deal with Iran, it didn't address the ballistic missile program of Iran, and it didn't address the terrorism and the regional destabilization. So I think in these negotiations that the ballistic missile program will be on the table. I think it's part and parcel of the Iranian nuclear program. I mean, you can't have one without the other, right? They've got to come up with a nuclear bomb, miniaturize it, you know, fit it to a warhead and then deliver it. And so, yeah, I think that although the front and center today is the nuclear program, the enrichment, I think the ballistic missile program is, you know, part and parcel of that overall nuclear program. And I think it will be addressed in a way that it was not addressed under Obama and Biden.
So before you were national security advisor in the Trump administration, you were the special presidential envoy for hostage affairs, involved in returning over 25 detainees and hostages to the U.S. You know, since October 7th, Israel has had this really terrible dilemma with the hostages. Everyone wants to see all of the hostages come home. But at the same time, certainly in the Misgav Center, we believe strongly that Hamas cannot be the dominant power in Gaza, whether it's officially or unofficially. So what advice would you give to Israeli decision makers who are dealing with this dilemma? What do you think the red lines should be?
So, it's such a difficult situation with these hostages. What I called for immediately after October 7th was for the U.S. to deploy Delta Force and DEVGRU, SEAL Team 6, to Israel to assist the Israeli Special Forces in rescuing the hostages. Because when I was hostage envoy, I always felt, especially with non-state actors, the best chance a hostage had of survival was to be a military rescue. And I think we proved that, you know, with Danny Burch in Yemen, with Walton in Nigeria. We've seen it with the Israeli rescues, some very daring rescues of the October 7 hostages. Otherwise, the hostages can be, you know, detained for years at a time, get sick, die, be tortured, you know, raped. Horrible, horrible things can happen to them. So I always believe that the number one, you know, priority for getting hostages back was to use the military. Now, of course, when they're in tunnels and Hamas has good operational security, you know, with these the remaining hostages, it's tough to do a military rescue. And so, you know, we kind of got to balance the you know, desire to get our hostages back. But now the Americans are all back, but or have been killed, like the poor Hirsch Goldberg. But the effort is to get them home, but. I think for Hamas to take the negotiations seriously, there has to be increased military pressure on them, and their space for holding the hostages has to be shrunk. So, you know, to put pressure on every side of Hamas, both above ground, below ground, and narrow their window of opportunity to hold these hostages. Yeah, and then present them with a deal that says, look, the hostages are only worthwhile to you. Yeah, if you get something from Israel for them, how about we let your people go and go to Tunis, like, you know, Yasser Arafat did in '82 with Beirut? You know, we'll let some of your people go in return for surrendering the hostages back to us. And don't forget, it's not just the live hostages; it's the remains of the hostages. And I include Matt Hader Golden and others who were. You know, killed, and the remains have not been returned to Israel, so they can't rest in peace in their own land. And I think the pressure on Hamas has to be upped, and that's not just by Israel militarily, but it's by the U.S. and European and Arab allies diplomatically. And we've got expecting goodwill from Hamas and just to return the hostages is a bad plan, because there's no goodwill from them. There's only hate and, you know, malign activity on their part. So we've got to really up the pressure on Hamas to get the hostages back, in my view.
If I can ask a personal question, you've said you grew up in California, you were a student at UCLA, and then during your sophomore year, you took off and you went to Brigham Young University and later joined the Church of Latter-day Saints. I've had the privilege of walking and touring the holy sites of Jerusalem with you. I think you know Jerusalem certainly better than most Israelis, probably better than most people in the world. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, you've been in these incredibly difficult and consequential positions as hostage envoy, as national security advisor. And I can hear the empathy and the compassion in your voice when you were talking about the American hostages, the Israeli hostages. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how your faith and maybe any other personal experiences played a role in these very consequential professional roles and decisions that you had to make.
Well, we belong to the Western civilization. If you think about it, that runs from Jerusalem to Athens to Rome, and the values that we get from the Bible, the Old Testament or the Torah and the New Testament really inform us in how we want to live our lives. And then, you know, one of the things that, you know, we believe in the West is personal freedom and the ability to worship God in our the manner of our choosing. And yet there are these, you know, organized efforts to keep Jews and Christians and I'm sure other good people in other religions from, you know, who practice their religion. And we've seen the Jews, who are their God's chosen people, if you believe the Bible, persecuted for 5,000 years. And, you know, diasporas time and again, whether it was Rome or, you know, the horrible events of World War II. Yeah, and my own faith is Latter-day Saints. We saw, you know, we were the only faith that had that pogroms organized in America against our faith, and you know, had to go out into the wilderness and you know, go out and make the desert bloom in Utah. You know, in many ways, like the Israelis have made the desert bloom in the Holy Land in Israel. And so I think there's a natural compassion, especially between Latter-day Saints and Jews. And you know, part of our doctrine is, as you know, Latter-day Saints and members of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is we believe in the gathering of Israel. And very early in the church's history, when we, you know, they had no money and a few members, they sent one of the early elders of the church to Israel to dedicate the land of Israel for the return of the Jews. So there's, you know, there's been a real sympathy between, I think, the Latter-day Saints or Mormons and Jews for many years, and shared experiences and the belief that we should be able to worship with, you know, according to the dictates of our own conscience. And yet there are so many people that you know, want to eradicate, you know, especially Israel, which is, if you look at you know, capacity of the people, Israel has done so much for the world, you know, in the past 50 to 70 years, culturally, scientifically, for peace. And yet they're in a very tough neighborhood. Yet there are these people that just hate Jews, hate Israelis. Anti-Semitism is on the rise, not just in the region, but you know, in Europe and even on college campuses in America. And so look, you know, I felt it's important. I've got, you know, good Arab friends and you know, good friends around the world in many different cultures. But I think it's important to stand up for our friends in Israel and to you know, recognize them as brothers and sisters and people that share our same values and have our same basic history. And, you know, to leave Israel alone is just unacceptable. And so look, I've tried to do what I can to stand with Israel. I've always put America first. I'm an American and Christian, but at the same time, you know, I recognize, you know, the inheritance that we have from Jerusalem. It's a rich inheritance. And it's and you know, I urge people, I tell people here all the time, go to Israel. You know, walk, if you're a Christian, you walk the paths that Jesus walked and see the history and the people there and the culture. And it's really an amazing place. It's one of my, you know, one of the favorite places in the world outside of America. And so I always feel at home there. And of course, it certainly influenced me. But you know, I, again, when it comes to the foreign policy of the United States, it's, you know, we're looking for what's best for America and what's best for our people. But we have to understand that corresponds very often with what's good for Israel. And so when those interests overlap, which is, you know, 95% of the time, it's an honor to work with my Israeli friends and pursue those goals that will bring, you know, peace and democracy and freedom to the world. And you know, Israel's a, like an amazing country. It punches way above its weight. It's like a little Sparta. And use a Greek analogy in a very, very difficult neighborhood. And there's, I look at Israel standing up for our values in a way that most countries don't. And they've got the courage to do it, and they've got the willpower to do it. And frankly, they have to do it to survive. So it's a plucky, great little country, and everything we can do to help Israel in the region, bring democracy and be kind of the shining city on the hill in the region is I think the benefit of the United States.
So you're now the founder and chairman of Amend Global Strategies, advisory firm in Washington, D.C. What opportunities are you seeing in Israel now that the brief war with Iran is over, the war in Gaza continues? You know, what opportunities do you see for American companies or investors, and what role do you think the Abraham Accords could play in that?
So I was on the radio show with Larry Kudlow, who is President Trump's NEC advisor and kind of a celebrity, has a Fox Business show. And Larry and I talked about this, and there's a possibility. I don't want to be Pollyannish about it or overly optimistic, because it's, unfortunately, the Middle East kind of disappoints you oftentimes. But if the people of Iran got their freedom, and at a minimum, if the Iranians stopped the terrorism and stopped the state-sponsored terrorism in the region, there's so much wealth in the Gulf that it could become a major engine of economic opportunity and prosperity for the world. And when you combine that with the Abraham Accords, the technical proficiency, the engineers and scientists in Israel, the cutting edge research that's been taking place in AI and quantum computing and machine learning and battery life and autonomous vehicles. Israel's after Silicon Valley, Tel Aviv is leading the way. I mean, it's probably Beijing and Silicon Valley and Tel Aviv that they have the most scientists and the most ingenuity and the most innovation. So if you took the monetary wealth of the Gulf Arabs and Iran, if it could stop using its money for nuclear nonsense and start using it to better its people in Iraq, you can have a massive capital market combined with the innovation and the scientific expertise coming out of Israel. And the Middle East could certainly become, I think, the economic engine of at least Asia and Europe in a way that no other region probably can. So there are tremendous opportunities in the Middle East. And look, one thing we saw with the Abraham Accords is how durable they were during this conflict. So after October 7th, when a lot of U.S. airlines and European airlines wouldn't fly to Israel, one of the ways that Americans were able to get in and out of Israel was through Dubai and Abu Dhabi, through the UAE airlines. They kept flying after the Abraham Accords, and then the deals kept flowing, and the economic intercourse between Bahrain and UAE and Israel kept going. And so I think the Accords have shown how durable they are, and how it benefits not just Israel, but it benefits the Arab countries to have that interconnection in the economy. And so, I'm very hopeful that Saudi will see how beneficial it is, and I think Saudi is the next country that could join the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, the KSA, who could join the Accords. And after that, who knows? Maybe Kuwait and Qatar and Oman and at least get the entire GCC in Israel.
Wait, I need to stop you. I need to ask you, do you think Qatar might join the Abraham Accords?
Look, I think it's very possible. I think Qatar gets a hard time, and maybe rightly so, but my experiences with Qatar is that they were, as hostage envoy, they were always helpful to America in trying to get hostages home. Qatar's in a very difficult place. It's an extraordinarily small country. I mean, 200,000 citizens. They're across a very narrow body of water from Iran, which could crush Qatar at any moment. And they share their biggest national assets are LNG fields offshore, which are shared with Iran. And Iran, the Iranian Navy, or the Iranian oil companies could make further exploitation of those fields very difficult if they wanted to. So Qatar's kind of in between a rock and a hard place, and I think if Iran became free, or at least if Iran could be put in a box, I think Qatar would much rather be part of the free world. I mean, they'd much rather do business with the United States and Israel and the GCC been with the mullahs and Russia. So I think Qatar's had to play both sides to some extent and still alive, being between a rock and a hard place. But I do think if Iran was less malicious, that Qatar would find its natural, kind of the home and more of the GCC, Israel and America. That's just my take.
Very interesting. And thank you so much for joining us. If you recall, the last time we spoke like this was in early October 2023, when we were preparing for a conference we planned to do later in October about the Abraham Accords. And then just a few days later, October 7th happened. And from the minute, the horrible minute that Hamas terrorists crossed over into Israel, began their rampage of murder and kidnapping and rape, to the 20 months later and how the Middle East has changed. And now we're talking about Iran's nuclear program being dismantled and Hezbollah being degraded and weakened and Hamas on its way to defeat. It's just unbelievable how much has changed over the last 20 months. I think that's a good sign or a good reason to be optimistic about the future.
Yeah, sure. It's unbelievable what Israel did. The operations against Hezbollah were just extraordinary. And everything from the pagers to the walkie-talkies to the solar panels to the taking out the Hezbollah leadership in the bunker. And then basically, doing a rinse and repeat and doing it in Tehran, 1,500 miles away, a long way from home, taking out over 30, terrorist leaders of the guard and nuclear scientists who were intent on developing a monstrous bomb to kill Americans and kill Israelis. I mean, and the air campaign Israel was able to pull these off and conduct the operations against Hamas, which are still ongoing. To Lahav's point, we've got to get those hostages home. We've got to finish off Hamas. But what Israel has been able to do in response to October 7th has been nothing short of extraordinary. And is a blessing to the people of Israel, but also a blessing to the people of the world. The number of terrorists that they've taken out and how they've changed the map of the Middle East, in just less than 2 years is quite extraordinary. And the Israeli people and the leadership, Prime Minister Netanyahu his team deserve a lot of credit for what's happened over the past 20 months. But I know it hasn't been hard. It hasn't been easy. It's hard to be deployed. It's hard to have a small country and an economy with so many reservists called up. It's hard for the families of the hostages. It's hard for the families of the servicemen and women, the IDF, that are involved in these dangerous missions. But Israel deserves a tremendous amount of credit for what it's done and how it's reacted to October 7th. It's been quite extraordinary.
Well, on that note, Ambassador O'Brien, we want to thank you so much for being here on the first episode of the Misgav Mideast Horizons. It's been very interesting, and we hope to have you back another time.
Love to come back. Thank you, and good luck with the podcast.
Thank you for listening to Misgav Mideast Horizons. We hope to be here every week on your favorite podcast platform. Please follow us and subscribe. Forward this to anyone who's interested in the latest news from the Middle East. And we'll be back next week.